This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear part two of our special First 100 Days series. We'll talk today with Shane Cottedall from the Center for Constitutional Rights and Mara Verheyden-Hilliard from the Partnership for Civil Justice.
Shane will talk about FISA, telecom surveillance, and Guantanamo. And Mara will speak about the monitoring and really making it awfully difficult for people to demonstrate these days on the ground.
Stay with us.
Shane Cottedall, an attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, was one of the chief litigators against Bush's warrantless wiretapping program. As our listeners know, legislation was passed in the last Republican administration that allowed certain kinds of warrantless wiretapping, and sadly, Obama went along with that legislation, failed to vote against it. So today we want to cover where we are with the warrantless wiretapping program. Recently, actually, in Eric Holder's nomination hearing, Senator Orrin Hatch asked Eric Holder what he thought of the new warrantless wiretapping law that had passed by Congress. And Holder gave, unfortunately, not the greatest answer you want to hear, essentially saying that the duty of the Justice Department is to defend statutes that have been passed by Congress. Well, that's where it is right now. We insist that that law be rolled back. Our next guest is Shane Cottedall, an attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who has specialized in everything from warrantless wiretapping to Guantanamo. Today, Shane will discuss with us the Guantanamo detainees, secret sites, warrantless wiretapping, national security letters, data mining, and the Patriot Act. Shane, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
And I know you're at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and they have a campaign for what a president ought to do in the first 100 days. And you have certain specialties, and I know you have some thoughts about it as part of the center's campaign. What is your thinking?
You know, an awful lot of what people want to hear from us is, a plan to close Guantanamo. Both of the presidential candidates have said that they want to see the base shut down, you know, that it does a certain amount of public relations damage to the United States, as well as being, you know, sort of a place where all sorts of human rights violations have occurred. You know, so even putting to one side, you know, the harm to the individuals who are held there, there's also a sort of systematic harm to the, you know, interests of the United States in keeping the place open.
That's what they seem to go on. When I hear these guys talk, that's what they talk about, because then when we'll get into it about the other secret sites and other places, Bagram, where they may or may not shut down. But let's look at Guantanamo for a second. When do you think they really will shut it down? And
sure.
If so, how are they going to do it?
Sure. Well, whatever their rationale is, it'll work for us at this point. But, there are really sort of three categories of people there. And there are the folks who, barring the existence of Guantanamo and military commissions, the government might want to try for terrorism-related offenses, people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and so
forth. A few of those, right?
Yeah. I mean, the number is uncertain. They've said that they may charge as many as 80, but an awful lot of people seem to be just being charged with being foot soldiers in the, you know, Taliban army, the army of the government of Afghanistan. That's not the kind of thing that people would usually be tried for war crimes.
No, I remember when they convicted Hamdan, supposedly bin Laden's driver, someone said, what are they going to do next? Convict his tailor, his shoemaker, and the guy who gives him a haircut.
Right. Well, you know, you can treat people.
I don't think he gets haircuts.
Right. You may not.
You know, folks who are cooks in an army get treated like soldiers, but none of them get tried for war crimes, right? The little joke that we were passing around was they didn't try Hitler's driver, right? And the fact that he got a 5-year sentence, which really amounts with time served to only a few months at this point, is really an indication that this isn't the kind of thing that was worthy of being tried as a war crime.
So of the 270 people at Guantanamo, the government says they may try 70. I think it's probably less, more
right.
like a
Maybe
handful.
Maybe two dozen, but, I think, is a lot closer to the, you know, folks who are genuinely involved with what we think of as al-Qaeda, you know, folks planning terrorist activities, that sort of thing. It's hard to tell. They haven't let us know an awful lot about what they accuse people being held at Guantanamo of to begin with. So that's one group, the people who, you know, would be tried in federal courts if Guantanamo had never existed. And for those, we think the solution is just that. For the most part, try them in federal courts, most likely the federal court right here in Manhattan in the Southern District of New York.
Well, we need something to replace all the jobs, you know.
So that's right.
All these guys can be security guards from Wall Street,
just
right?
Just a few blocks over, yes. You know, you hear an awful lot of talk about national security courts being required to protect classified intelligence information in these sort of trials, I think that's by and large nonsense. We've proved with the embassy bombing trials here, with the 1993 bombing trials, that exactly these sort of offenses can be successfully prosecuted in federal court and there's not going to be damage to the national security.
I agree with that. Very little makes me angrier than hearing that kind of stuff.
Right. So that's group one out of the three groups at Guantanamo. Then the second group is really the people who never should have been there in the first place, and that's an awfully large group. You know, realistically, if you look at the idea that they may charge as many as 80 people, well, there's 255 left. That means there are close to 200 people, you know, who the U.S. government will eventually send home, just like the 500 other people who have already been sent home from Guantanamo. And very few of those are in detention or have been tried, you know, in the countries they've been sent to. You know, you can, you know, count them on the fingers of your hand, basically. So that's a very large group, and there are, you know, all sorts of interesting subgroups within there. There are about 110 Yemenis right now who are just parked there basically waiting for a diplomatic agreement around their return, you know, for the most mundane sort of things to be worked out between the governments. And Yemen is a poor government without a lot of sway. So whereas the Saudis have gotten pretty much all their citizens back home, Yemen hasn't. That's the second group, and that's a relatively easy group to deal with. Any new president could come in, wouldn't have to wait for Congress or anyone else to do anything, could just send these people home. The third group is a group we refer to as basically Guantanamo's refugees, and these are people who come from countries with horrible human rights records: Libya, Tunisia, Uzbekistan, Syria. There's a longer list than that, about 13 countries where we ordinarily wouldn't send people home. If they were in the immigration system here in the U.S., they'd probably get asylum. You know, and the problem is the U.S. has yanked these folks out of places where they were living perfectly peaceful lives, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and so forth, and brought them to Guantanamo. And now, you know, it's going to be difficult to return them to the countries where they were living informally as refugees, and we can't really in good faith return them to the countries that they're citizens of. So we've got to find, you know, traditional asylum accepting countries to send these people to, largely in Europe. And unfortunately, the Europeans don't really want to do this administration any favors right now. That may change immediately after the election, but right now they see this as America's mess and America ought to take a first step towards cleaning it up. That group is the most problematic, I think, because a diplomatic solution may need to be found there. And certainly, you know, the U.S. needs to do its share. And that may require a little bit of intervention from Congress, although it's unclear. It depends on the individual case.
Shane, moving on from Guantanamo to less visible detention centers the United States keeps, what about the secret sites, those sites that make torture possible?
Is that part of 100 days demands also?
You know, again, that's the kind of thing that's done sort of outside the purview of the law, right? And so it's really something that's entirely within the executive's power to stop doing. Although I suppose that, you know, when someone is rendered to a country and you know, essentially the U.S. gives instructions for what it wants to be done with that person, but the other country then sort of takes the ball and runs with it, then those issues are a little bit more complicated, I suppose, in terms of putting an end to those practices. But ultimately, I think this is something that's, you know, entirely within the executive's purview. There are things we can do, though.
When you say within the entire, that means that a next president could decide to end the secret sites.
Right, right. And, you know, keep in mind the entire rendition program really was started under President Clinton. An awful lot of detail about it, by the way, in Jane Mayer's new book about his administration's involvement in sending people to you know, third countries, you know, expressly for interrogating them under torture. That's not to say that the other branches don't have a role in this. And you know, the Military Commissions Act was notable not just for creating a system for trying suspected terrorists in military courts, but it also basically provided immunity for government officials who participated in, you know, all the illegal conduct that we're complaining of both at Guantanamo and these sort of black sites. You know, that's something that could be changed. You know, essentially the Military Commissions Act provides immunity for a broad array of people who were involved with things that would have been violations of the War Crimes Act or the Anti-Torture Act and so forth. So, you know, we've always called for, you know, not reform of the Military Commissions Act, but basically wholesale repeal. We think that's an important symbolic measure, just as closing Guantanamo in its entirety is an important symbolic measure. But that's one thing that could be done to address the black sites problem, because once you do that, then any U.S. officials who are participating in these black sites have to worry the rest of their lives about criminal prosecution for what they did, you know, outside the view of the media and Congress and all the rest.
So in terms of the 100 days and your program, closing Guantanamo, repeal the MCA, that might get rid of the black sites as well. Mm-hmm. What else? Habeas?
Sure. You know, repudiate, obviously, the whole practice of using black sites in rendition. You know, repealing the MCA would basically restore habeas corpus to the sort of full flower that it had had after the Supreme Court decided our Rasool case in 2004. So that's something that kind of falls under the umbrella of repealing the MCA. You know, I guess we'd look to the courts, really, to sort of be a little bit more assertive against the executive. You know, certainly having a new president in power whose Justice Department isn't making the kind of crazy arguments that we see from the Bush Justice Department in its last couple months here, that kind of thing will go an awful long way towards restoring proper judicial oversight over detentions.
What about torture, Shane? We know that the CIA has refused to renounce its use of waterboarding. We know that the Army's got a new set of regulations that far exceed what they used to do. What can be done in that respect, torture and cruel and inhuman treatment of people?
Sure. Well, there have been an awful lot of proposals out there to basically sort of revert to the model of the Army Field Manual, for instance, which basically, sort of didn't include within the universe of acceptable interrogation tactics any of these sort of things that have been adopted since 9/11. That's just one measure that's out there. It would be great to see, Congress sort of sit down and think about what acceptable measures are. You know, one nice thing about using the Army Field Manual as a model is that it was basically designed by interrogation experts, the sort of people who have had long experience and know from practical experience that torture doesn't work at producing reliable information. In some sense, the outcome of relying on sort of, veteran military interrogators might be a little bit more positive than what we might get out of Congress being responsive to a public that, sort of gleans what torture is all about from TV shows.
Now, a lot of this can be done by a president himself. I mean, by executive orders and others. And that's one of the reasons for the 100 days, I gather. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. That sort of thing is something that could be done, with the stroke of the pen, as President Clinton used to say.
Now, the other area you've been working on, I know you were the chief attorney at the Center for the Foreign Surveillance, litigation over warrantless wiretapping. Mm-hmm. And can you bring us up to date on the latest legislation on that? And then what your hopes are in a new administration, or what can happen in the first 100 days?
Sure. Well, the historical model for surveillance, whether it was under FISA or under FISA is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
The secret court.
Right. The secret court that approves wiretaps directed at individuals who are, accused of being part of a terrorist group or working for a foreign government somehow. This is the usual means of intercepting phone calls that come from outside the United States to inside the U.S. and vice versa. Then for domestic wiretapping, there's a whole different set of rules with slightly higher safeguards. But all of these rules were sort of thrown for a loop when Congress passed in the last couple months FISA Amendments Act. And the historical model for wiretapping has always been that law enforcement, the executive branch, has to go to a judge and present a little bit of evidence indicating why a specific person ought to be is worthy of suspicion, such that the court should allow the government to go and wiretap them, right? And whether it's foreign intelligence surveillance under FISA, which is the law that enables surveilling people who are part of terrorist groups or working for foreign governments, or whether it's domestic surveillance for purposes of prosecuting someone criminally under what's called Title III, the Wiretap Act. Either way, that's the model. You go to a judge, you get a very specific order directed at that one person, usually at one telephone line. Now, what the administration has wanted to do, it seems here, is do something much broader than that, to get outside of that model of going to a judge with specific evidence and getting specific authority for a very limited sort of wiretap. Instead, what they seem to want to do, and this is I'm basing this on what's written into law now in the FISA Amendments Act that passed this summer, what they seem to want to do is be able to get authority from the judge to go and just do a wholesale program of wiretapping. And they'll give the judge the criteria in very rough terms. We want to listen to any call that comes in from Afghanistan at 2 a.m. where somebody calls a whole bunch of people afterwards, that kind of thing, and just get, carte blanche.
Or they could, for example, say we want to listen to any calls coming into the Center for Constitutional Rights from the Middle East.
Well, the law specifically prohibits using a pattern that's designed to catch to target the communications of somebody in the U.S. or a U.S. person living overseas or so forth. So that protection is in there. But if they wanted to, swipe in, use as a description, for instance, an entire category of our clients living overseas, people who weren't U.S. citizens, well, then they could do that, and they would effectively get all of our communications.
Right, all people at Guantanamo or who have left Guantanamo, all people who have been released from Guantanamo or their family.
Sure. Any, you know, Pakistani who has a family member at Guantanamo,
right.
Something like that.
That would,
you know,
pick up our communication.
It seems, in theory,
center.
Like that's something they could do under the new statute. So, you know, but the interesting thing about this, and, you know, taking one step back, is that it really gets away from that model of specific suspicion, specific evidence, and a specific warrant that limits the discretion of law enforcement. You know, while Congress said you have to go to these FISA judges, the FISA judges are really approving a whole program of surveillance and not one specific targeting decision. And you can imagine the FISA judges don't have an awful lot to go on. Really, all they're supposed to figure out is whether, you know, this program that the government proposes to them is likely to pull in, you know, communications of U.S. citizens. So, you know, it really gets away from kind of the classic Fourth Amendment model. You know, the colonists wrote the Fourth Amendment with the warrant requirement in it because they were concerned that the king had issued these general warrants, these things that basically let his agents run around wherever they felt like there might be violations of the Stamp Tax Act or something like that. You know, it basically let law enforcement run wild within civil society. That's the reason the Fourth Amendment was put in place, with all these requirements about getting very specific warrants. And that's what this FISA Amendments Act has really sort of erased from the law. And so there's, you know, an interesting open question, which is being litigated now, over whether or not this complies with the Fourth Amendment. But beyond that, you know, on its face, it seems like it's the antithesis of what the Fourth Amendment was all about. And, you know, one worries that judges are going to decide, well, you know, really the Fourth Amendment is outdated, and they're going to let this pass when it finally gets up.
Yeah, what's interesting here is, I know we don't discuss our presidential candidates, but both of them actually voted in favor of the mm-hmm. Foreign Intelligence Surveillance
right.
Act Amendment.
Right. Obama switching relatively at the last minute to vote in favor of it. The other problem is, you know, of course, a president could come in and decide not to use this power, but there's going to be a great deal of inertia from the intelligence agencies who had 5 or 6 years of using this sort of power, either under the NSA program, the illegal NSA program, or under this act that's going to be 6 or 7 months old by the time the new president gets into power.
Right. So they've been using this now for 6 or 7 years. They're not going to want to stop overnight.
Right. It's hard to get rid of that sort of entrenched thing. You know, they'll come to the president with all sorts of arguments about, you know, how it works well and how hard it would be to do things differently now. You know, so this is an area where Congress may need to step in and basically restore some of the post-Watergate era restrictions that were put in place, I think, very wisely in the FISA Act when it was passed in 1978. So this is one area where, in theory, the president could stop things with a stroke of the pen. I think it's probably unlikely to happen, especially since both candidates did support the bill. And therefore, I think we may need to have a little bit of a public political discussion about it and have Congress act.
In terms of domestic repression, and I know the executive can't unilaterally do this because it was passed by Congress, but I'm speaking about the Patriot Act and the offensive provisions that act entails, including a sneak and peek, the government's requesting records from courts and doctors and universities and any kind of public record a person might establish, even credit. What might you do with those overreaching of a government spying?
Sure. Well, you know, an awful lot of them, you know, haven't been used to the extent I think that we might have predicted when the Patriot Act was passed. So, for instance, there's a preventive detention provision in there that says they can hold non-citizens for 7 days without charges, either immigration charges or criminal charges. But, you know, that thing has never been invoked because the president has instead used, you know, what he thinks is his, you know, sort of commander-in-chief power to just detain people for years without any charges, whether they're U.S. citizens or not U.S. citizens.
Well, I remember when the Patriot Act provision came out, I was very upset by the preventive detention provision of it. And then, of course, as you just said, the president said, well, I'm the commander-in-chief. I can hold people forever no matter what.
Right. Now the Patriot Act looks like the very model of checks and balances.
So, it's true on that issue, Shane.
Now, there are a lot of disturbing things out there. The national securities letters powers, which have been sort of tinkered with by Congress since then. The FBI seems to be using this quite a bit. That's something the president could stop by fiat. But again, it might be a good idea to have a little bit more of a national debate about this because, you know, this is another way of getting around the wiretapping statutes and their ilk.
Well, talk about what national security letters are.
Sure. Well, these are basically letters that the FBI issues. And, you know, in their original form, I believe you weren't even allowed to sort of divulge them to a lawyer to see whether or not you could bring a legal challenge to them if you were presented with one of these letters. I think they're issuing somewhere around 2,000 or 3,000 of these a year, basically to request large, you know, quantities of data, whether it's somebody's, you know, sort of habits of checking out library books or, you know, I don't know actually how broad they've managed to use it, but there were some some talk that it could be used for things like phone records and so forth. Then that kind of thing would ordinarily require, again, those sort of orders that you would go to a court for, whereas this instead is just something the FBI can do on its own. There may be a lot of practical difficulties in actually bringing a legal challenge to it.
Let me remind our audience that we're speaking with Shane Katidil from the Center for Constitutional Rights, senior litigating attorney at the center. It seems to me, Shane, that their effort here is like a vacuum cleaner. They just want to accumulate large amount of data and then kind of sort it out, a concept that's really offensive. The government's supposed to reveal what it has, and the citizen's supposed to be private, and they've taken it and they've turned it on its head. What do you think is going to happen with respect to that, you know, broad inquisitive powers that they say they have?
Well, this really gets at the idea that the NSA program and whatever they're doing under the FISA Amendments Act is really, you know, more akin to data mining, which is this idea where the government pulls in a huge amount of data, both from private sources and from things it can accumulate itself, and then searches for patterns in that data. So they take all your calling records and then, you know, see whether or not you made a lot of calls at a certain time of day to a certain region. You know, if someone called from Afghanistan and into the U.S. and then the person in the U.S. called 10 people within 5 minutes, that might be an example of something they would think is a suspicious pattern. Or it may mean that someone got married in Afghanistan and you decided to spread the news, right? It's, you know, that's kind of a model for how data mining might work. And, you know, the government seems to have been going around and accumulating a big database of all sorts of information. We know that they were seeking calling records. This story broke in the middle of 2006 for the past, you know, several years from all the phone companies, and pretty much all of them complied. We know they've been seeking search engine terms in a different context from internet providers. We know that they have been working with SWIFT, which processes interbank transactions, to get huge amounts of financial transfer data, financial transactions that happen anywhere in the world. And they're putting all this into a database and trying to see whether or not they can spot terrorists by applying pattern analysis to this sort of thing. You know, the first problem with that is we don't know whether or not it works. You know, it's very likely to have a very high sort of false positive rate. It seems in a lot of respects to be very similar to any other kind of profiling that the government does. You know, we're familiar with the kind of crude profiling by race, but that sort of Afghanistan call example that I gave you, you know, it might be just as likely to pull in people who never should be made the targets of suspicion. And yet, you know, the fact we have so little human intelligence on the ground worldwide, and particularly so little in the Arab world, I think makes this very tempting to the intelligence agencies to look to. You know, folks are always looking for technological panaceas for lots of problems, and this, I think, is one special area where the agencies really want to do this. You know, it doesn't seem like there's an awful lot standing in their way.
Shane, John Ashcroft, when he was the Attorney General, told the various government bureaucracies that if there was a Freedom of Information Act request, you know, that right that we won because of the struggles in the 60s for a transparent government, if there was such a FOIA request, Ashcroft said, don't give it to them, and if they want to litigate, I'll back you up. What can we do about that?
Well, again, that's something that having a new attorney general in office will, you know, hopefully solve on its own. You know, but again, I think this goes to the notion of, you know, sort of defections and morale in the Justice Department. I mean, we've seen, you know, over 8 years, a lot of people who, you know, as career DOJ people might have been willing to serve under a moderate Republican, you know, president, just getting disgusted and leaving, and they're being replaced by people with, you know, very suspect, I think, intellectual qualifications. You know, hundreds of these Regent Law School graduates. Selected because of their, you know, ideological affinity with the craziest sort of theories of unilateral executive power that this executive has put forward. So with folks like that in civil service positions, you have to worry that, you know, on a smaller scale, some decisions like that are going to be made that are effectively bad faith decisions on how to enforce open government laws and all the rest, even after we have a better attorney general in power.
Yeah, because these people will still be left there, a lot of them. As civil service jobs. Well, Shane, we really appreciate your being with us for the first 100 days. Let's see what happens. Are there any concluding remarks to our audience?
Basically, there's no way it can get worse. So
I think, bite your
tongue. Grounds for optimism.
So. That's actually, there is a change going on, we hope.
Yeah, I won't guarantee that for your mortgage, but for your government, inevitable improvement.
Shane Katidil from the Center for Constitutional Rights, thank you very, very much for coming down and talking with us on
thank
Law and
you,
Disorder.
Shane. We'll be right back.
radicalizing dissent has chilled most free speech movements in the United States, especially when demonstrators take to the streets. We talk now with attorney Mara Verheyden Hilliard, co-founder of the Partnership for Civil Justice Legal Defense and Education Fund, about criminalizing dissent, surveillance, data mining, fusion centers, and the ability to exercise First Amendment rights. A recent example were the violations of free speech during the mass arrests of protesters at the 2008 Republican National Convention. The demonizing of protesters and their message in the media will usually allow for the use of military force by police. Mara Verheyden Hilliard, welcome once again to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Heidi. Thanks for having me.
Mara, you've got the most extraordinary practice, you and your partner, Carl, down in D.C. What went into your thinking about what kind of lawyer you wanted to be and the kind of practice that you and Carl set up?
Well, as you said, Carl Massinio and I co-founded the Partnership for Civil Justice in the mid-90s, and we formed this organization and this public interest law firm because we wanted to be able to carry out very particular work on behalf of people in the United States, people who are not being served in other ways, but work that also would directly confront corporate powers and government powers, work that we felt would never be carried out pro bono by a corporate law firm, and that other organizations, you know, could not do. And we had both looked around and thought, you know, we went to law school believing we wanted to do public interest work and looked around at other groups and other organizations, many of which do quite excellent work, but saw that there was no entity doing what we really wanted to do, and decided right out of law school that we would undertake this very significant effort and start this organization, which we have been successful in doing.
And can you tell us about some of your early cases, then bring us up to the future in terms of the kinds of cases you choose, what it means, for example, when you represent certain kinds of individuals and how you select those?
We have always done constitutional rights, economic justice litigation, and we have over the years brought very significant cases on behalf of people who were subjected to race discrimination, gender discrimination, disability discrimination, discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, against very large corporations as well as the government. And as well, we bring cases, and this has been a significant focus of our practice, on behalf of political activists and organizations across the United States whose work is disrupted, attacked, who are subjected to police brutality and surveillance by both local police agencies, municipalities, as well as the federal government. So a lot of our work is at the intersection of First and Fourth Amendment rights.
Now, I know that a lot of those protest cases go back as far as, I think, year 2000, many of which are in D.C., and that you still have cases pending from World Trade Organization protests in D.C.?
Indeed, we still even have a class action litigation that's pending from the April 2000 IMF World Bank protests, in which the police, working with federal agencies, carried out massive attacks on peaceful protesters over several days, including raiding and seizing the Convergence Center, shutting it down illegally, arresting organizers, carrying out a mass arrest of nearly 700 people who are lawfully protesting on D.C. sidewalks, beatings of people in the street. And the fact that this case has been litigated heavily for 8 years really says a lot about the nature of what we want to do and the kind of work that this is, because the government has dragged this case out for 8 years because they don't want people to take these cases and because they want plaintiffs to give up. They hope that there will be early and toothless settlements or that plaintiffs won't be able to find attorneys who are willing to do these cases at all. We know that liability is established here. In fact, earlier this year, we one for a magistrate judge summary judgment, a recommendation for summary judgment in our favor on the mass arrest of the entire class. And yet these cases are not resolving because the government simply does not want to give up just fighting this out, just a war of attrition.
In New York, during the 2004 Republican National Convention, there were a couple of lawsuits, as I recall, brought by groups who were not given permits to protest on the Great Lawn of Central Park. In fact, one of those groups gave up when the court initially denied their motions. But you stuck in. You had a parallel lawsuit, and you stuck in and indeed have had a great victory in that case.
In New York, as you said, during the 2004 Republican National Convention, Mayor Bloomberg and the police sought to stop people from having the right to assemble on the Great Lawn of Central Park, which in Manhattan is the single location that is hospitable for mass assembly. And instead, we're telling groups that, you know, they could go have these sort of long marches or standing along, you know, lengthy avenues of New York City, but that's far different than being able to have political speech in a rally. They basically want to transform demonstrations into parades without political content. There was one organization that had been denied the right to rally there. They initially accepted the police's recommendation that they go stand on the West Side Highway. There was a lot of opposition from activists and people that want to demonstrate and didn't want to do that. And once they did that, other organizations that we were working with, the National Council of Arab Americans and the Answer Coalition, had been planning to have a mass rally on the Great Lawn of Central Park in defense of civil rights and civil liberties for the very targeted Arab and Muslim community in the United States, which has suffered the brunt of extreme repression from this government since 2001. We went into court, sought a preliminary injunction for the right to be able to be in the Great Lawn of Central Park. We lost at the preliminary injunction level. The other organization also went into court. They lost at the preliminary injunction level, but we decided to keep going because we felt we couldn't let the government tell people of New York City and people from around the world who come to New York that they don't have the right to have political speech in the Great Lawn of Central Park. And after several years of litigation, earlier this year, we had a very significant victory in which the government has now had to rescind its regulations with regard to restrictions on the number of people who can be in Central Park. They have been sent back to the drawing board, and we have maintained an informal settlement that we, in fact, will go back into court when they promulgate new regulations if those regulations are not constitutionally sound.
Mara, let's fast forward. If it wasn't for you and your lawsuit, the people would be told that they can't attend the inauguration. What's the story down there on this issue?
Well, in D.C., we've been fighting for Pennsylvania Avenue, which is called America's Main Street, running from the Capitol down towards the White House, which is the location of most major demonstrations and parades and marches in the history of Washington, but is where every 4 years you have the quadrennial presidential inaugural parade. And for a number of years, since the National Park Service has had jurisdiction over the area along Pennsylvania Avenue, what has been happening is it's been privatized. So at this presidential inaugural parade, where people come from all over the country because they want to sometimes protest the incoming administration and give their message at this one moment when the president is riding by in the limousine, and other people come just because they want to witness history, they set up bleachers up and down Pennsylvania Avenue and use the bleachers as a political mechanism to restrict access to Pennsylvania Avenue. And this came to a head January 2001 at the beginning of the first Bush administration when groups we were working with wanted to protest the incoming administration, and we had to fight for the right of people engaged in political protest to be along the parade route. And again, in 2005, we had to go into court on an emergency injunction, seeking an emergency injunction, again trying to stop the Bush-Cheney National Park Service from completely privatizing the parade route and trying to stop demonstrators from being along the parade route. Because what they want to do is they want to stage manage democracy. The eyes of the world are on Washington on January 20th every 4 years. And if the president is coming down the parade route and you have thousands and tens of thousands of people protesting Bush and Cheney, they didn't want the world to see it. You have the first African-American president in history within people's lifetimes who've lived through Jim Crow apartheid in the United States. Regardless of what people may think of the Democratic Party or the corporate nature of the Democratic Party, and I think that we have no illusions about what that means, no matter what, this is still a very historical day for people.
Mara Verhaelen-Hilliard from the Partnership for Civil Justice, we want to reintroduce you to our audience. We've been discussing your great victory in D.C. in opening up the parade route to the American people and taking it away from Bush-Cheney Parks Department. But we also wanted to step back and talk about Bush-Cheney. what you believe and we believe has happened over the last almost 8 years has really been historic, that there's been a diminution in democratic rights, a qualitative diminution, we think, and that the bar is being set even lower than it was when W took office in so many respects. And we wanted to get your reflections where we are now and where we need to go and how we get there.
I think we've certainly seen a major negation of democratic rights and constitutional rights in the United States under Bush Cheney these last 8 years, or perhaps I shouldn't say a negation of constitutional rights, because constitutional rights stand no matter what, but certainly an effort from the government to disrupt, to disrespect, to trash those rights in practice. And I think it's important to recognize that much of what we saw under Bush and Cheney did not begin under Bush and Cheney. It's important to recognize that really since the 70s, since the Church Committee hearings, there's been sort of a ongoing effort to put the police state back into place after the exposure of COINTELPRO and after the exposure of mass violations of people's civil rights in the United States. There was the Church Committee hearings. People had great outrage and uproar over this. The government said, we won't do it again. They put in the Levi guidelines. And then little by little, you can see those being chipped away over the years. Unquestionably, though, when we hit the Bush-Cheney years, and after September 11th, which they were using cynically, not just for their adventurous war on terrorism, but the component part of a shift in domestic policy in the United States in an effort to suppress dissent against the war on terrorism, they went into overdrive. And over these years, there has been just a huge usurpation of government authority, of the government working against people's rights to organize, people's rights to express opposition to the government. And among one of the major things that we've seen and that we've uncovered in discovery and that we're continuing to fight is the creation of this significant surveillance state, essentially a secret police operation against the people of the United States.
Several of the cases you have litigated try to get through the curtain of what has been put in place by the Bush administration. What kinds of legal challenges do you see?
I think, as I was talking about, I think it's important not to have illusions and not to misunderstand where we are because of the Bush-Cheney administration, because in order for us to take the next steps, to take the next steps under a new administration, is it enough to say that we want to go back to January 19th, 2001, to just the day before Bush took office, or is there more that we have to do? We have to have an honest assessment of where we are in order to know where we want to go. And when you look at the incoming Obama administration and what we think they're likely to do, there has been, as I said, a creation of a very significant surveillance state, a very significant secret police state. We believe that it is critical that if the Obama administration is serious about restoring people's civil and constitutional rights, that what they must do is immediately engage in an audit of all the federal agencies, federal law enforcement agencies, and their data collection on the people of the United States. There are millions of people in the United States who have done no wrong, many of whom have engaged in free speech activities or religious activities, and simply by effect of those lawful activities are now entered into government law enforcement databases. We think there has to be an audit of every agency's databases to determine exactly what the databases are, to identify what has been collected, where it has been put, who has access to that information, to tell people of the United States individually what has been collected on them, and then to expunge it. Because for people in the United States to have their government collecting information, maintaining information on these in these massive database files that can be used by law enforcement, that gets pulled up at a moment's notice, is really a very dangerous practice. It is a secret police practice. And what they're doing is they have misused existing databases and data tools, databases like high-intensity drug trafficking area databases, violent gang and terrorist organization file, and many other types of databases that were created and authorized solely to address specific issues like drugs, like terrorism, but instead are putting law-abiding people in those databases or people that have engaged solely in protest activity and First Amendment activity. It has to end. They have to stop it. They have to tell us what they have. They have to tell us who's in it. And then they have to take those people out and take this information out and wipe it clean.
In many of your lawsuits, and one that comes to mind is the group of individuals dressed in black who police followed into a parking garage and then proceeded to ask personal questions about their political affiliations and associations. In that lawsuit, you challenged that police tactic, arresting people based on the perception that they were, in this case, anarchists, then went ahead and asked them information that is really improper to ask.
That's right. In that lawsuit, which is titled the Bulger case, but the folks in the case refer to themselves as the Stir Fry, because they had left a lawful protest. They'd gone back to their car and garage. They were eating stir fry from the car when suddenly there was this mass assault from police charging down the garage, arresting them all, interrogating them. For years, the police lied about who was there. We were able to establish that FBI was also on the scene, that undercover FBI agents, it appears, had infiltrated the protest. These folks had done nothing wrong. They were subjected to an illegal mass arrest and then interrogated about their beliefs, their associations, their political beliefs, where they had been, who they were staying with. They were asked to roll up their shirts, sleeves, and pull up their shirts and show tattoos. They were asked to show piercings. These things were being filmed. They were collecting information on their political slogans and, you know, slogans on their shirts and political literature. So there's no basis in anything that pretends to be a free society. But this isn't the only case where we have this. We've been able to establish that these mass arrests that have been conducted, and we're handling two large class actions, one of 400 and one of 700 people in different incidents in D.C., that these mass arrests are used as massive intelligence gathering operations by the government, not just local police, but the federal government, that people's names are collected, that their associations and identity with political activity is collected. This is some of the information that we want to demand an end to, but I think the collection of information is so much broader than that. But here's the challenge that we face. The fact is, and I think that, you know, in terms of the issue of not having illusions as we move forward now, because there is a lot of hope from people that there will be change, for there to be change, we have to understand what the stakes are and what the realities are. The Obama administration is going to be faced with the usual sort of threat from the right wing, and in this, you know, based on the war on terrorism or the threat of terrorism. And if Obama lifts this mass intrusion into people's lives, lifts and eliminates this vast Fourth Amendment and First Amendment violations of people's privacy and people's rights, that would require him to expend political capital that I think realistically he is not going to be willing to expend. I mean, you can imagine the meetings with Rahm Emanuel, with Assembly the Attorney General Eric Holder, who used to be the U.S. Attorney in D.C. during some of these early protests that we're still litigating. And he's going to want to shield himself from right-wing attacks, the right-wing attacks that would say, if there is a terrorist attack or something happens to the United States and you have altered the police state at all, then that's your fault. And the easiest way to defend against the sort of threat of the right-wing on this constant omnipresent threat of if there is a terrorist attack is to not alter the police state. I think that their desire is going to be not to alter the police state at all. And the one way that it will happen is if there is a mass public demand and opposition, which is why we are launching a campaign at the Partnership for Civil Justice along the lines of what I was talking about before, of people joining with the partnership in this massive demand from below that the databases be identified, that the information that's been collected be identified, that we learn the breadth of access and disclosure, and that there be expungement. That's the only way that it's really going to happen, is a massive campaign coming from people. And historically, if you think, you know, under the Clinton administration, and really ever since the late 70s, liberal public opinion has always been fearful of the right wing and attacks coming from the right wing. And because of that fear, people so often then ultimately end up embracing a right-wing agenda. Like you say, well, I don't want to get attacked if there ends up, you know, being some terrible thing that happens, and so therefore we can't dismantle the police state because we're afraid of the right wing. Well, then you end up completely embracing the right-wing police state agenda. And you think about it with Clinton. You know, he kicked 7 million kids off welfare in, you know, a snap of the fingers overnight. He enacted the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which negated habeas and introduced secret evidence under a Democratic president. And people didn't fight in mass numbers because there was this constant omnipresent assertion that were you to criticize, were you to fight, that it would support the right wing.
Mara, what's your website at the Partnership for Civil Justice? We want to link up to it, and we want our audience to be able to grab their pen and pencils and write it down.
It's www.justiceonline.org. That's justiceonline, all one word, .org. We urge people to come to the website. We are launching this new campaign to end the secret police state and expunge and expose the files. And we want people from all around the country to join us in this demand. That is the way that it will happen.
You've talked to us in the past on Law and Disorder about the number of lawsuits that you've brought, and many of which are still pending from eight years ago, a lot of them involving protesters who have been gathered up, from whom political information has been taken and arguably put into different databases or kept on file somewhere. With the change in administration, it sounds, from what you've said, that you don't expect any speedy resolution if, in fact, the government wants to prolong these as long as possible to discourage other people from bringing this kind of lawsuit.
I don't know. You can never know exactly what political determinations people will make. But from our perspective, we prepare every case and bring every case for trial. And we intend to take these cases to trial unless we can get a fair resolution for all of the people that have suffered these extreme abuses at the hands of law enforcement authority. So that's the direction we're going. If it's possible to resolve these, we would resolve them. But in the absence of fair resolution, people will have their fair day in court.
What's been your impression so far of the various appointments that the Obama administration has been making?
Well, I think they're very telling. I mean, there's been great discussion about change we need and change we can believe in. I can't say that Rahm Emanuel would fall into that category, nor at this point, you know, could we say that Eric Holder does, or really any of the people you see them bandying about for these major positions. It's all these folks that, you know, are have been brought back from the Clinton administration, and we don't know how many, you know, other people that they're going to bring in that are Republicans. It's ultimately a center-right kind of lineup. I think it's important to recognize that. And Rahm Emanuel, you know, certainly when it comes to issues of Palestinian self-determination and justice for the people of Palestine, is a very, very concerning appointee. I mean, his father was a member of the Irgun, you know, which was a terrorist organization.
I'll do you one better. His father named him, Rahm, after a guy in the Lehi, which were the Stern Gang, which was even worse than the Irgun.
Yes. I mean, this is reasonably concerning for people. I mean, what does that say for the people of Palestine? What does that reasonably say? The one thing that has happened is that so many people are now engaging in political activity, even if it was, you know, going to the voting booth, because they've been told, and honestly in many cases lied to, that that is the single act of democratic participation in the United States there is. But there is so much hope that there has to be an answer to that hope. And I think there's many, many people that want to see change, that believe the words when they hear that, you know, they are the change they've been looking for. The issue is now what will happen if this administration, as I think we can expect, is not going to have the major changes and the hope that people are yearning for in the United States. How will those things come about? They will come about the way they have always historically come about, which is from a mass people's movement coming from the ground up. And that, I think, is the hope that we all have at this point, that we can see that's what's coming. And that's what, you know, within the Partnership for Civil Justice's work, you know, our view is that we want to keep the streets open and the sidewalks open and the parklands open for democracy, for people's right to be in the streets, to demand what is just and what is fair.
Mara Verhaelen-Hilliard, well said.
Thank you and Carl and the partnership for your important litigation and freeing it up for the public.
Thank you very much for having me on.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.